Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, December the 7th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, Fossil Find is One of a Kind for Iowa. Vertebrae comes from a mosasaur, a prehistoric marine reptile. It's written by Nick Heitrek. Tyler McDonald keeps his eyes open for any unusual items when unloading rock onto buildings during roofing jobs. Little did the Sanborn, Iowa roofer know he'd made not only an unusual, but a one-of-a-kind discovery when he fished an odd-looking item from the rocks during a job back in 2015. I picked it up and looked at it a little. It looked like a bone, McDonald said. I just wanted to know what it was from. He'd just found three fused vertebrae. At nearly 4 inches long, the fossil isn't that big, but its discovery is a pretty big deal. The vertebrae come from a mosasaur, a prehistoric marine reptile, and until McDonald's sharp eyes spotted them, a mosasaur fossil had never before been discovered in Iowa. I didn't expect to see something like that, McDonald said. His discovery eventually was brought to the attention of Morningside College Associate Anatomy Professor Kurt Spearing, whose research during the past 2 years determined the fossil is indeed from a mosasaur. In October, he presented his findings to the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America. If my assertion is correct that this is the first mosasaur discovered in Iowa, that would be significant in itself, said Spearing, whose research focus is paleontology. Thus far, no one has challenged his claim, increasing the probability that the fossil, quarried from a gravel pit near Ashton in Osceola County, is the first evidence of mosasaurs found in Iowa. It makes sense, given northwest Iowa was on the edge of a large inland sea millions of years ago. Anytime you can drag scientific knowledge forward a few steps, you've got to consider that a win, Spearing said. McDonald was referred to Spearing by one of the professor's colleagues in North Dakota. When he first saw the fossil in 2021, it was obvious they were vertebrae. Doing comparisons, he quickly determined they likely were from a mosasaur, a large marine reptile that lived between 65 million and 99 million years ago. Spearing compared the fossil with those in other museum collections, and shared photos and a 3D scan of the fossil with other experts who agreed he had the fossilized tail vertebrae of one of two species of mosasaur, a creature whose fossils have been found in Nebraska, South Dakota, other Midwest states, and around the world. Not a dinosaur, a mosasaur is instead a marine reptile, Spearing said. Looked like a lizard with a long skull and flippers instead of legs. It was considered an apex predator that would have eaten anything smaller than itself. Spearing said the first appearance of a fossil in a geographic area is always interesting, and it's even more so when considering fossils aren't found that often in this area because the rock around here was not as conducive to creating fossils. The mosasaur vertebrae has been donated to the University of Iowa Paleontology Repository and is on loan to Spearing for a year, while he continues his research. Spearing said it's unlikely he'll be able to determine which species of mosasaur the fossil came from, but its rounded edges have some experts thinking it could have gone through another animal's digestive system, theorizing the tail could have been bitten off and eaten by another prehistoric predator. Sediment could be scratched away from the fossil and analyzed to determine what type of rock it came from. There's almost always something you can try to find out, Spearing said. As he continues his research, Spearing is writing a research article further making the claim it's the first mosasaur fossil found in Iowa. It's a spectacular find, he said, made even more amazing by the unlikely circumstances of its discovery among a pile of rocks. It shows there's another world beneath our feet just waiting to be found. There could be a complete mosasaur skull 50 feet beneath us, but unless it washes out, we'll never know, Spearing said. It makes one want to take a closer look at that river rock in the backyard landscaping. Next is an article entitled, Jury Issues Split Verdict in Double Murder Case. Man Found Guilty of One Murder Charge, Not Guilty on Another. A Sioux City man received a guilty verdict on a second-degree murder charge on Wednesday morning, but was not guilty on an additional second-degree murder charge. Joseph Cruz, age 20, of Sioux City, was charged in Woodbury County District Court on two counts of second-degree murder for the October 29, 2022 shooting deaths of his cousin, Anthony Williams, age 19, and Carlos Aguirre, age 21, in the early morning hours at 1421 West 5th Street. Cruz was found guilty of killing Aguirre, but not Williams. Cruz and Aguirre were among a dozen or so people at a party where guns were being passed around. Two had posed with three other young men for a photo in which all five were displaying handguns. Witnesses testified that Cruz and Aguirre began to argue over the ownership of one of the guns, then got into a physical altercation. At one point, Aguirre displayed the gun and cocked it. During a struggle for control of the gun, it fired and eventually fell from Aguirre's grasp. Cruz picked up the gun and shot Aguirre in the back of the head and in the back. Williams, who is Cruz's cousin, was shot in the chest during the scuffle for the gun. The defense argued the shooting was self-defense, and Williams's cousin, Angel Williams, testified he saw Aguirre advancing toward Cruz before he was shot. Aguirre died at the scene, and Williams was pronounced dead at Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center. Prosecutors contended Cruz shot Aguirre because he was angry Aguirre would not give up the gun, which he had bought after Cruz gave him the money to make the purchase. Sentencing has not yet been scheduled. It brings us to an article entitled Sioux City Police Seeking Suspect. It's written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. The Sioux City Police Department is seeking the public's help in locating a suspect wanted in connection with a Sunday homicide, as well as two persons of interest. Detectives are looking for Farron Allen Starr, who is a suspect in the fatal shooting of 31-year-old Nathaniel John Parker III, according to a statement from the department. They are also attempting to locate Nathaniel Erlwin Frazier and Amanda Lynn Hayes, who are described as persons of interest. Subjects should be considered armed and dangerous, the statement said. Anyone with information is asked to call the Sioux City Police Department at area code 712-279-6440 or anonymously at 712-258-TIPS, T-I-P-S. In November of 2022, Starr pleaded not guilty of stabbing his ex-girlfriend. He is scheduled to stand trial in Woodbury County District Court in February on charges of willful injury, second-degree burglary, going armed with intent, third offense domestic abuse assault, and two counts of felon in possession of a firearm. A public bench warrant was filed for Starr on October 25th, according to court documents. At 11:58 p.m. Sunday, police responded to a call of shots fired in the 500 block of 9th Street. At the scene, they found Parker with a single gunshot wound. He was pronounced dead at the scene. On November the 7th, a Woodbury County jury found Parker guilty of assault causing bodily injury for the February 24th death of William Harlan Jr., who was fatally stabbed in the back seat of a car in which Parker was riding with him. Parker had been charged with first-degree murder and had faced an automatic mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. Instead, he was found guilty of a lesser charge, a serious misdemeanor that carries a one-year jail sentence. Parker had been in jail since February 24th arrest. After the November 7th verdict, District Judge Jeffrey Neary, who presided over his trial, ordered Parker to be released from custody on his own recognizance pending a November 21st sentencing hearing. At 4:38 a.m. on November the 8th, hours after getting out of jail, Parker was found climbing up a fire escape in the same block where he would be shot less than a month later. He was drunk, half-naked, and had a minor stab wound. Parker was booked into the Woodbury County Jail earlier on November the 8th on a charge of public intoxication, a simple misdemeanor. He pleaded guilty and received a one-day suspended jail sentence. On November 21st, Neary sentenced Parker to probation for the stabbing. He gave Parker credit for 221 days served in jail while awaiting trial and suspended a one-year jail sentence on a charge of assault causing bodily injury. Neary sentenced him to 30 days in jail on a related drug possession charge and credited Parker for time served. Parker was placed on probation for 1 year. Our next article is entitled, Here's How the Iowa GOP is Planning for the Caucus. It's written by Caleb McCullough of the Journal Des Moines Bureau. Iowa Republicans will gather in just over a month in schools, churches, and community halls to cast their vote for the presidential nomination and kick off the national primary season. The high-profile presidential caucus requires meticulous planning from state and local officials to secure locations, organize volunteers, and get the word out to voters. The caucuses are held across more than 1,600 local precincts every 2 years to organize party business, but attention and attendance surges in years when there is a contested presidential nomination. We take great pride in the fact that we are well organized and that we do anticipate it to be highly successful with great activity of registered Republicans, said Polk County Republican Party Central Committee member Chris Werman, and it's an important step in democracy. Iowa Democrats will hold party organizing precinct caucuses on the same day as Republicans, January 15th. But they will express their presidential preference using a new mail-in process and won't announce results until March 5th. The change came after National Democrats booted the state from their early nominating spot in an effort to redesign the calendar in a way that better represented the party's demographics. For the Republican caucuses, voters will gather on January 15th at 7 p.m. at designated precinct locations. Before the presidential preference poll, representatives from each presidential campaign can make speeches in support of their candidate. Attendees will then cast their vote for president by writing a name on a slip of paper. Those votes are counted and reported to the state party. Once voting is over, caucus attendees move on to party business like electing delegates to the county convention and proposing items for the party platform. Where will Republicans caucus? Local parties need to find locations to hold their dozens of precinct caucuses. County parties will often host multiple precincts at one location in less populated areas. Finding locations with enough space is sometimes difficult, said Woodbury County Republican Party co-chair Susan Stewart, because of the uncertainty of turnout. We had a caucus many years ago when we probably misjudged the space, and we kind of had fist fights in the parking lot because people couldn't find places to park, she said. That's my caucus nightmare, is that people will complain bitterly because they didn't have that opportunity. Kelly Koch, the Dallas County Republican Party chair, said one challenge this year will be making sure Republicans know where to go to caucus. The locations are different from a person's voting precinct, and the precincts were redrawn after redistricting in 2021. So many people are creatures of habit, she said. Now it's like a Hansel and Gretel. You've got to train people to go to this site. How many people will participate in the caucuses? County officials said they expect participation in this year's caucus to be on par with 2016, in which a record more than 186,000 Republicans cast their vote for president. The previous two contested cycles, 2012 and 2008, saw turnouts of around 120,000. Some precincts in Woodbury County that hadn't previously seen much turnout surged in 2016, Stewart said, largely because of the new voters former President Trump brought to the caucuses. Trump did drive some of the high turnout that year, but he took second place after U.S. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. There's so much interest in Trump and Republican candidates since 2016, she said. Things have just changed a lot in the Trump era, so we could have a very robust turnout. But the field is also much narrower than it was in 2016. Only a handful of candidates remain in the race, which could discourage turnout for supporters of candidates that have dropped out, Koch said. I think that could go either way. I really do, she said. Trump leads the field for GOP candidates as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley are in a tight battle for second place, according to the recent Iowa polling. Other candidates include Ohio biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and Texas pastor Ryan Binkley. How many volunteers are needed? Running the caucuses takes thousands of volunteers who help sign voters in, set up caucus sites, count the votes, and guide the process. Party officials are working to recruit volunteers for each county precinct and train them on the process. Depending on the size of the precinct, county officials said they need between 3 and 10 volunteers for each precinct. Recruiting volunteers has not been difficult because of the high interest in the presidential election, officials said. It varies from precinct to precinct, but it's really not that difficult to find people because people do participate in the caucus and are willing to help with whatever duties are before the evening, Werman said. Democrats to separate party organizing presidential preference. Iowa Democrats will hold their party organizing caucus on January 15th and express their choice for president via a mail-in process starting in January. The party's new presidential preference cards will include the names of incumbent President Joe Biden and two long-shot challengers, U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota and author Marianne Williamson, along with an option to remain uncommitted. With the caucus separated from the presidential selection, participation on caucus night is likely to be low, said Scott County Democratic Party Chair Kay Pence. The party will elect delegates for the county convention and work on the party platform. We're planning it to be the amount of participation like an off-year caucus, she said. So we're having them all at one location rather than at all the individual precincts. Pence said she's excited that the presidential selection will happen by mail this year, making it open to more people who traditionally can't get out to their caucus location. Democrats can request presidential preference cards by mail or email, and the party will begin mailing them on January the 12th. For the first time ever, this will be a totally inclusive presidential selection process, she said, because in the past, if you didn't like driving at night or you were a snowbird, went south for the winter, or you had a job with second shift, or you had small children at home, you couldn't get out. People can participate now. Pipeline company prevails over two Iowa county ordinances is the title of our next article, and it comes from Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A federal judge on Monday permanently barred two Iowa counties from enforcing their ordinances that restrict the placement of carbon dioxide pipelines. Shelby and Story counties adopted restrictions after two companies proposed to build pipeline systems to transport captured carbon dioxide from ethanol plants and other facilities. The ordinance sets minimum distances to locate the pipelines away from cities, homes, schools, and other sites. They also have some requirements that pertain to emergency response plans in case of a pipeline breach. Summit Carbon Solutions, which hopes to build a five-state pipeline system to transport the greenhouse gas to North Dakota for underground sequestration, sued the counties and argued that they lacked the authority to impose the restrictions. The company said the federal government is charged with regulating the pipeline's safety and that the Iowa Utilities Board has authority over their placement. Chief Judge Stephanie Rose of the Federal Southern District of Iowa agreed. Rose granted Summit summary judgments in both lawsuits on Monday and issued permanent injunctions to block the counties from enforcing the ordinances. The challenged restrictions impose severe limitations that will lead to a situation where the Iowa Utilities Board may grant a permit to construct a pipeline and Summit is unable to do so, Rose wrote in the Shelby County decision. The Story County decision contained a similar rationale. Rose ordered the counties to cease enforcement of their minimum distance and safety requirements, give written notice to county employees of the injunctions, and prove they have complied with the order within 10 days. An attorney for the counties did not immediately respond to a request for comment for this article. Summit declined to comment, but sent an email to an unspecified number of county supervisors on Monday to inform them of the judge's decisions. This final order is significant, underscoring the precedence of federal and state laws over local ordinances in regulating major infrastructure projects like ours, wrote Kylie Lang, senior project manager for the company. It reinforces our position that local setbacks and safety standards cannot intrude upon the authority vested in federal and state agencies. Summit also has a pending lawsuit against Emmett County for a similar ordinance. Another carbon dioxide pipeline company, Navigator CO2, had sued Bremer, Emmett, and Story counties, but dismissed the litigation after it announced in October that it was canceling its project. The threat of litigation has prevented other counties from adopting pipeline ordinances. Jan Norris, a Montgomery County landowner whose property is near the path of Summit's proposed pipeline, said she has been urging her county supervisors for more than a year to restrict how close it can be to houses and other places. She said one of the homes in her area is within 300 feet of Summit's proposal, and she believes the family that lives there would be swamped by carbon dioxide within minutes if the pipeline has a catastrophic failure. They have said, "We can't pass an ordinance because Summit is going to sue us," Norris said of her 5-person board of supervisors. They are paralyzed with fear. Mike Olson, the chairperson of the Montgomery board, said he has long doubted that counties have the authority to regulate the pipelines, and I did not want to drag our county into a lengthy legal battle. He is a farmer who thinks the pipelines will benefit the ethanol industry and, by extension, the amount of monies farmers are paid for their corn. More than half of the state's corn crop is used to produce ethanol. Olson said the board considered an ordinance identical to Shelby County's, but decided to wait for the federal judge's ruling before proceeding with any votes on the advice of his county attorney. Fears about pipeline breaks are frequently voiced by opponents of the projects. They stem, in part, from a carbon dioxide pipeline rupture in Mississippi in 2020, when a confluence of atmospheric conditions caused a plume of the leaked gas to travel toward a small town. About 45 people sought hospital treatment, and 3 nearly died. Federal regulators have said the leaked gas typically dissipates rather than forming a dense plume. Summit has said its pipeline would be one of the safest ever built. The U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration is in the process of revising its safety regulations for the pipelines and plans to publish its proposed changes in June of the year 2024. Despite the threat of litigation, other Iowa counties are considering enacting ordinances. Last month, the Dickinson County Board of Supervisors directed its Planning and Zoning Commission to draft one for its consideration. "If this is adopted, we're getting sued," Dickinson County Attorney Steve Goodlow said, told the board, according to the Dickinson County News. Goodlow told the Iowa Capital Dispatch on Tuesday that the judge's rulings against the Shelby and Story County ordinances will not prevent his county from pursuing its own ordinance. He did not know when it might get final approval. In South Dakota, counties have been successful enacting ordinances that govern where the pipelines may be located, and those ordinances were part of the reason utility regulators denied Summit's pipeline permit request in September. Summit has said it is working to modify its route to comply with the county requirements and will reapply for a permit. It's unclear when that will happen. Good Samaritan dies, 2 others injured in crash. This comes from Dakota County, Nebraska. One man was killed and 2 other people were injured in a series of accidents that involved 3 vehicles near the area of mile marker 2 on I-129 Wednesday morning. The initial accident, which occurred around 5:07 a.m., involved a 2008 Toyota Camry stolen out of South Sioux City, the Dakota County Sheriff's Office reported. The Camry was eastbound on I-129 when it struck the center median barricade. 2 separate Good Samaritans stopped to help the driver out of the vehicle. At that time, a second passenger vehicle, also eastbound, struck the first vehicle as well as the 2 Good Samaritans, killing one and injuring the other before colliding with a 3rd vehicle that was parked on the shoulder. The man who died was identified as a 66-year-old from South Sioux City. The Good Samaritan and the driver of the 2nd vehicle were transported to local hospitals for their injuries. The man driving the stolen vehicle fled the scene on foot prior to the arrival of sheriff's deputies. The Dakota County Sheriff's Office said there is no description of this person at this time. The Dakota County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Nebraska State Patrol and the South Sioux City Police Department. The investigation is ongoing. Anyone with information about the collision or the man who fled the scene is asked to contact the Dakota County's Sheriff's Office. Moose on the loose in Dickinson County. Dateline is Spirit Lake, Iowa. Dickinson County officials reported Wednesday morning that a moose is on the loose. Just before 10 a.m., the Dickinson County Emergency Management posted on Facebook that dispatch is aware of the moose roaming around the Spirit Lake area. Dickinson County Emergency Management then cautioned area residents, "If you see the moose, do not approach it. Leave it alone. It will find its way out of town." In late September, the Sioux County Sheriff's Office reported that a moose had been spotted near Rock Valley and was wandering toward Sioux Center. Previously, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, has said on its website that moose will occasionally wander into Iowa from Minnesota. These are usually young bulls, and they rarely stay long, the Iowa DNR notes. In January of 2022, Plymouth County had a visit from a moose who was spotted near County Road K-22. Moose are a protected species in the state of Iowa. Now we'll move to the opinion page, and we've got another view from the Las Vegas Review-Journal entitled "Impossible is Happening for Medicaid. Enrollment falls for government program that's supposed to be last resort for needy." Former President Ronald Reagan once noted, "No government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size." That's true, which is why what's currently happening with Medicaid is so remarkable. During the pandemic, Medicaid enrollment grew dramatically because the federal government tied increased emergency funding to a provision that prevented states from removing ineligible individuals from the rolls. Medicaid enrollment ballooned from 65 million people to more than 94 million people earlier this year. That's more than a quarter of the country's population. So much for Medicaid being coverage of last resort for the neediest. Reagan foresaw that outcome. The rest of his above quote states, "Government programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth." To prove his point, the White House kept renewing the emergency order even as the pandemic faded. This was a backdoor effort to permanently expand Medicaid. But Republicans in December of 2022 rescinded the continuous coverage mandate, forcing states to disenroll those who were improperly using Medicaid. Progressives, eager to see more Americans become government dependent, warned that enforcing eligibility requirements would lead to a massive spike in the uninsured. That hasn't happened. As the Wall Street Journal noted in August, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services projected a less than 1 percentage point increase in the number of uninsured Americans once the pandemic emergency provisions expired. Although Medicaid enrollment is expected to decrease significantly, CMS concluded, many individuals who were not disenrolled from Medicaid during the public health emergency already had comprehensive coverage from another source, such as through an employer, and thus remain insured even when disenrolled from Medicaid. The process is working. Already more than 11 million people have been disenrolled. Again, enrollment standards haven't changed. States are now simply confirming eligibility and removing those who no longer qualify. In addition, safeguards are in place. An appeals process, retroactive coverage for those inaccurately removed from Medicaid because of bureaucratic mistakes. If Democrats want a debate about expanding this entitlement program, fine, but etching temporary pandemic emergency provisions in stone isn't the way to go about it. Cleaning the rolls by enforcing eligibility provisions will, Reason.com noted, save taxpayers an estimated $80 billion annually. Even for the government, that's real money. You're listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First, we remember Stanley Solheim, who from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. We're saddened to announce the passing of Stanley Solheim, age 85, who died peacefully over the weekend in a hospice ward in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. Stan grew up in Sioux City and graduated from Central High School, the Castle on the Hill. He served in the Coast Guard until May of 1960. Stan raised his family in Rock Rapids, Iowa, with his wife Karen. There, he started a successful import/export and pipe manufacturing business called SR Supply, Inc. Stan enjoyed simple things in life, including golf, jigsaw puzzles, going for walks, and enjoying ice cream to watching Jeopardy. One of his proudest accomplishments is how he reclaimed his health after serious illness in 1999. Next, we remember Patricia Pat Mackey, age 92, of Sioux City, who passed away December the 4th, 2023, at a local care center. A funeral service will be held at 12 p.m. Thursday, December the 7th, with visitation 1 hour prior at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 2915 Glen Avenue in Sioux City. Now we remember Cindy R. Struve Slinger, age 66, of Pearson, Iowa, who passed away December 1st, 2023, at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. Funeral services will be held 1 p.m. Saturday, December the 9th, at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley, Iowa. Visitation begins at 11 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Next, Anna M. Seespanek, age 82, of McCook Lake, died Friday, December the 1st. Memorial Mass will be held 1 p.m. Saturday, December the 9th at St. Blessed Teresa of Calcutta Parish, 995 North Sioux Point Road, Dakota Dunes, South Dakota. Visitation will be held at 11 a.m. with a rosary. Now we remember Virginia M. Wenzel, 95, of South Sioux City, who passed away on December the 3rd. A funeral service will be held 12 p.m. Friday, December 8th, with visitation 1 hour prior at Woodbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Next, we remember Darvin John Hartman, age 101, of Hinton, Iowa, passed away peacefully on Monday, December the 4th, at a Sioux City nursing facility. He had been living at home since August of 2023. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December the 8th, at Trinity Lutheran Church in rural Hinton, with the Reverend Klaus Robb officiating. Burial will be at Floyd Valley Cemetery, with a luncheon following. Visitation will be at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, with family present from 6 to 8 p.m. Prayer service will be held at 7 p.m. Memorial donations will be directed by the family to Trinity Lutheran Church and Floyd Valley Cemetery. And finally, we remember Wilma Carol Schmidt Grau of Lawton, Iowa, who passed away at the age of 88 on December the 4th at Sunrise Retirement Home. A funeral service will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December the 8th at Bethel Lutheran Church in Lawton. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the church. Waterbury Funeral Services of Sioux City is handling the arrangements. TV legend Norman Lear dies at the age of 101. Norman Lear, the writer, director, and producer who revolutionized primetime television with All in the Family, The Jeffersons, and Maude, propelling political and social turmoil into the once insulated world of TV sitcoms, has died. He was age 101. Lear died Tuesday night in his sleep, surrounded by family at his home in Los Angeles, said Laura Berthgold, a spokesperson for the family. I'll read an article entitled, "It's Not Going to Work Financially. Rising Prices Prompt Closure of Longtime Orange City Bakery." It's written by Mason Doctor of the Sioux City Journal, and the dateline is Orange City, Iowa. Rising prices have compelled the longtime Orange City Bakery to close its doors. The Dutch Bakery, 221 Central Avenue Northeast, is closing its doors December 30th, proprietor Lauren Mulder told the Journal by phone. "Every year we kind of look through our financial situation, and every year what we've seen is that as our prices increase, we have to raise our prices because our ingredients, our costs increase. We tend to be losing sales," Mulder said. "And so we can see that in the future, it's not going to work financially. And in fact, we've done many things to try to be as efficient as possible, but it's gotten to the point where can't do a whole lot more. There's not too many more hours in a day that I can work and still be a sane human being. And so we've just made the decision that while I'm still young enough to do some other things with my life, it's probably time to shut down the bakery, he added. All of our costs are increased, just like everyone else's. You know, with inflation, things have really gotten quite expensive. Not quite retirement age, Mulder said he's received a new job offer. I can work less hours, make the same money, he said. Mulder purchased the bakery in 2009 from Arne Vermont, who along with brother Darwin opened it in the mid-1970s. It was originally called the Royal Dutch Bakery, according to contemporary news accounts and advertisements in the Sioux City Capital and Alton Democrat newspapers. The Vermont's father, John, had also operated an Orange City bakery for decades. An accident prompted Mulder's acquisition of the bakery 14 years ago. I'd been in agriculture since 1983. We'd been farming, and I was in a truck accident in 2008 and messed up my neck, and my family joke was that I would buy the bakery someday because I liked to bake. I bake for my kids and that sort of thing, Mulder said. And one of the kids said, well, Dad, why don't you go see if it's for sale? And since I was recuperating and didn't have a lot I could do, I walked in and asked if it was for sale, and it was, so I bought it. The bakery is noted for its donuts, Dutch pastries, and their special Dutch almond pretzels and almond patties, a variation on the Dutch letter pastry. The almond patty is similar to the Dutch letter. The story that I was told is the original Dutch bakers in the area tried to sell the Dutch letter, which has a lot of almond paste in it, and so it's quite expensive. Almond paste is very expensive, Mulder said. So the original settlers in this area were fairly poor or were fairly Dutch and wouldn't pay that price, and so the bakers thinned out the almond paste so that they didn't have to charge as much. But then they couldn't roll it into a letter, so they just laid it the pastry over the top of the almond paste and baked it that way, and just made kind of a little patty with a little less almond inside, and that sold. Whether that's true or not, or it's just a fun story, I don't know for sure, he added. I'm not that old. The building and equipment are for sale, Mulder said. It's unlikely to continue on as a bakery, barring some unforeseen reversal of fortune. No one has really been interested in purchasing it, he said. We had it for sale for about 2 years, and we had no responses. Nebraska may need to replace 97,000 lead pipes. This is written by Chris Dunker of the Lincoln Journal Star. Water utilities across Nebraska would be responsible for replacing tens of thousands of lead pipes over the next decade under a rule proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency last week. The update to the lead and copper pipe rule pushed by President Joe Biden aims to reduce lead in drinking water and curb public health crises that have stemmed from the aging infrastructure. Lead in drinking water is a generational public health issue, said, and EPA's proposal will accelerate progress toward President Biden's goal of replacing lead pipe across America once and for all, EPA Administrator Michael Reagan said in a news release. Across the country, that means nearly 9.2 million lead service lines would need to be replaced within 10 years after the rule is finalized at a potential cost of $625 billion. In Nebraska, that means an estimated 53,230 lead pipes must be replaced, according to the 7th Drinking Water Infrastructure Needs Survey and Assessment published in April. The environmental nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council estimates the number of lead pipes remaining in the Cornhusker state is significantly larger, potentially reaching as many as 97,000. An inventory on the number of lead pipes in communities across the state is due to the EPA by October of 2024. EPA Assistant Administrator for Water, Radhika Fox, said the proposed rule was built on lessons learned from several cities across the U.S., including Newark, New Jersey, Benton Harbor, Michigan, and Green Bay, Wisconsin. EPA's proposed lead and copper rule is grounded in the best available science and successful practices utilized by drinking water systems to protect children and adults from lead in drinking water, Fox said. Our proposed rule applies the lessons learned to scale these successes to every corner of the country. Lead pipes were typically used to connect water mains to homes and businesses until 1986, when they were banned by the EPA after it was determined lead can leach into tap water and severely harm adults and children. Utility companies have never been required to remove or replace those pipes with non-lead alternatives, however, even as the EPA has implemented and overhauled rules regulating the quality of drinking water. The EPA has planned a public information and listening session on the proposed rules, which it plans to finalize in October of the year 2024. Now we'll turn to sports, and our first article is entitled USD Gets Rematch with NDSU in Playoffs. It's written by Dave Driesen of the Sioux City Journal, Dateline Vermilion, South Dakota. The University of South Dakota upset then number 2 North Dakota State 24-19 back on September the 30th. USD's first win at Fargo since 2015 helped propel the Coyotes to their best regular season in NCAA Division I Football Championship Subdivision, FCS, and the number 3 seed in the playoffs. To keep their championship hopes alive, the Coyotes must now accomplish a rare feat, beat the 9-time champion Bison for a second time in the same season. Making their first appearance in the FCS quarterfinals, USD will host NDSU in front of a sold-out crowd at the Dakota Dome and a nationally televised audience Saturday. "I'm excited to have our fans get to experience this level of a contest," USD head coach Bob Nielsen told Midco Sports. "We're playing one of the top programs, if not the top FCS program in the country, and we have them right here in the Dome." The Coyotes reached 10 wins for the first time since moving up from NCAA Division II in 2008 after beating Sacramento State 34-24 in the round of 16 last Saturday. After kicking a field goal at the end of the first quarter to take a 3-0 lead, USD quickly turned 2 Hornet turnovers into 2 touchdowns. The second came on a 54-yard fumble return for a touchdown by freshman defensive end Maquise Grace. Quarterback Aiden Bauman completed 11 of 16 passes for 174 yards and 2 scores, 18 yards to Javian Phelps and 75 yards to tight end J.J. Galbraith. The latter was USD's longest pass completion this season. Charles Pierre Jr., returning from an injury, ran 13 times for a career-high 123 yards. North Dakota State advanced to the quarterfinals by outlasting number 6 seed Montana State 35-34 in overtime last Saturday. Tamarick Williams ran 11 times for 162 yards and 2 scores in the thriller in Bozeman, which ended when Casey Kotzman blocked the point after try in the extra period. Making their 14th consecutive appearance in the FCS quarterfinals, the Bison have captured 9 titles, including a record 5 straight from 2011 to 2015. Last season, NDSU lost the championship game to rival South Dakota State, 45-21. Top-ranked SDSU beat both USD and NDSU in consecutive weeks this season by scores of 37-3 and 33-16, respectively. The Coyotes lost just one other game, the top 10 ranked Missouri of the SEC in the season opener. North Dakota State's only other loss came against in-state rival North Dakota, 49-24. In their September win over the Bison, the Coyotes scored touchdowns on all 3 drives in the first half, led 21-3 at halftime, and withstood an NDSU rally for the second half. Bauman threw for 168 yards on 10 of 12 passing and connected with Carter Bell on touchdowns of 50 and 52 yards. Nielsen cautioned reading too much into the results of that game, which came so early in the season. "The Bison are different in the fact that they've improved," Nielsen told Midco Sports Saturday. "NDSU played great football the second half of their schedule. They had a tremendous win out at Montana State. They're going to come in here with a lot of momentum. But our team has a lot of momentum, too, in the way that we've played. A USD win Saturday would equal a school record for wins in a season at 11, first set in the year 1986, when the Coyotes finished as the NCAA Division II runner-up." In another college football article, Kentucky team looks to deny Raiders title game return. This also is written by Dave Driesen of the Sioux City Journal. The dateline is Orange City, Iowa. For the second straight season, Northwestern will host a NAIA semifinal football game in December. The Red Raiders dominated Indiana Wesleyan 38-7 in 2022's Final Four game in Orange City en route to their first national championship since 1983. Noon Saturday at DeValios Stadium, Northwestern will face Georgetown, Kentucky, which beat Indiana Wesleyan 31-21 in last weekend's quarterfinal. The Red Raiders, the number one seed, advanced with a 34-17 win over St. Xavier of Illinois in Orange City. Northwestern has won 26 straight games, with their last loss coming to Morningside in the 2022 season opener. The Red Raiders are led by GPAC Offensive Player of the Year, Jalen Gramstead, who has thrown for 3,182 yards and 30 touchdowns and rushed for 705 yards and 8 more scores. The junior from Lester, Iowa, was named the player of the game in the 2022 championship game as Northwestern erupted for 28 second-half points to beat Kaiser, Florida, 35-25. In last week's win over St. Xavier, Gramstead passed for 217 yards and accounted for 3 touchdowns. Freshman wide receiver Austin Gerard caught 2 touchdowns and defensive back Cody Moser picked off a pass. Moser, a junior from Rock Valley, leads the NAIA with 10 interceptions. Fifth-year senior Michael Story of Spencer, Iowa, who became the school's all-time leader in receiving yards, is tied for fourth with 13 catches for touchdowns. Senior running back Connor McQuillan is sixth nationally with 18 rushing scores. Number 4 seed Georgetown is led by quarterback Gehrig Sluniker, who threw for 126 yards and a touchdown in last weekend's win over Indiana Wesleyan. Darius Neal added 142 yards rushing for the Tigers. The two teams will meet for the first time in each program's history. The winner will advance to the NAIA championship game on December 18th in Durham, North Carolina. A potential title game rematch between Kaiser and Northwestern looms. Kaiser will host College of Idaho in the other semifinal contest Saturday. College of Idaho, the number 11 seed, knocked off number 2 seed Grandview 31-17 in the quarterfinals in Des Moines last weekend. Kaiser, the number 3 seed, blasted number 7 Bethel of Tennessee 56-14 in the quarterfinals. Next is an article entitled Change Unlikely for Iowa in Bowl Game. Iowa faces Tennessee January 1st in Orlando. This is written by Dave Selvig of the Quad City Times. When the Hawkeyes take the field on New Year's Day in Orlando, don't expect major changes. Different QB? Doubtful. A new-look offense? Unlikely. Iowa, seeking its 11th win of the season, will look similar to the team that consistently found a way to win unconventionally this season. The Hawkeyes' formula of relying heavily on their defense and special teams has resulted in a 10-3 record, a number 17 national ranking, and a spot in the Citrus Bowl against 21st-ranked Tennessee, with a team head coach Kirk Ferentz is quite fond of. Somebody pointed out to me, it was 25 years ago when I started in this position, and I feel very fortunate about that, Ferentz said. During that time, we've had a lot of really good teams, and I've had the privilege to work with a lot of outstanding players. But this group that we've worked with this year is about as good as we've had, certainly amongst the most outstanding group that we've had. A lot of tremendous players, gotten great leadership, made great improvements, stuck together. Sticking together references a team that is not fractured despite an offense that has scuffled mightily. The Hawkeyes' struggles were on full display for the college football world to see in the Big Ten championship game Saturday night. They had just 7 first downs and 153 yards. Only Navy has fewer first downs than the Iowa Hawkeyes this season. Quarterback Deacon Hill has struggled since taking over for the injured Cade McNamara. Ferentz has steadfastly stood by the Californian as the starter because of his play in practice, but acknowledged, "We don't have guys stacked up that were 5-star recruits." Iowa's average output of 16.6 points per game is unlikely to be enough against Tennessee on January the 1st. Led by another Michigan transfer, quarterback Joe Milton, The Vols averaged 31.5 points per game and more than 435 yards offense per contest. Tennessee is good on defense, too. The Vols' 36 sacks are the 10th most in the country. Iowa's sturdy defense limited Michigan to 213 yards in the Big Ten title game and ranks fourth in the nation in points allowed per game at 13.23, led by tackling ace Jay Higgins. The Hawkeyes will need a similarly stellar effort on New Year's Day in Orlando against one of the SEC's top teams. Iowa has more than held its own against teams from the Ballyhooed Conference. The Hawkeyes are 7-6 all-time against SEC schools in bowl games, including last season's 21-0 blanking of Kentucky. The work Josh has done at Tennessee and Central Florida before that is just outstanding, Ferentz said of head coach Josh Heupel, who is 26-12 in 3 years at Rocky Top. Really good program. It will be a great challenge for us. In college volleyball, Wayne State makes Elite Eight. Wildcats begin NCAA 2 title run Thursday versus Cal State LA. It's written by Gene Schnitzel of the Omaha World Herald. It's already been a busy December for Kelsey Cotta. It's about to get a lot more hectic, and the Wayne State senior can't wait. This coming Monday, Cotta, a sport management major who graduates in the spring, leaves for the NCAA Division I Volleyball Final Four in Tampa to volunteer with the American Volleyball Coaches Association at that event. But this week, Cotta has her own championship to chase. Her Wildcats are the third seed at the Division II's Elite Eight as they will face six-seeded Cal State Los Angeles at 11 a.m. Thursday. Semifinals are Friday. The title match is Saturday. It's the second time in program history that the Wildcats have advanced past regionals. We're still not satisfied, said Cotta, a Wahoon Newman graduate who is second in kills for Wayne State this season. We have a bigger goal in mind. We want a national championship, and winning our regional and making the Elite Eight is just stepping stones in that direction. Here's a rundown of today's sporting events that are on television. At 6:30 p.m., men's college basketball on ESPNU, it's Iowa at Iowa State. In women's college basketball, at 6 p.m. on the ACC network, it's Duke at Clemson. And at 9 p.m. on the Pac-12 network, it's Gonzaga at California. In NBA basketball, at 4:10 p.m. on ESPN, it's the Eastern Conference in-season tournament, Indiana versus Milwaukee's semifinal in Las Vegas, and at 8 p.m. on TNT, it's the Western Conference in-season tournament, New Orleans versus the LA Lakers. It's a semifinal game, and it's also in Las Vegas. NFL football, tonight's Thursday night game at 7:15 p.m. on Prime Video is New England at Pittsburgh. In the National Hockey League, at 7 p.m. on ESPN, you can catch Dallas at Washington. And at 9:30 p.m. on ESPN, you can see New Jersey at Seattle. Since we got a little time, let's finish up with the Ask Amy column. It's entitled, Mom is Worried About Friend Who Wants More. Dear Amy, I am in my 40s and a single adoptive mother of two girls. Many years ago, I met Jeremy on an internet dating site. While I wasn't romantically attracted to him, we became friends. From our first meeting, Jeremy made it very clear that he wanted more than friendship from me. I was honest in stating that I viewed him as a platonic friend and that it wouldn't go any further than that. We have remained in touch over the course of 11 years, with the exception of a very brief marriage of his. He has become a dear friend. We laugh and commiserate. I'm open to dating if someone compatible were to come along, but my daughters come first. I like being single. Jeremy continuously makes not-so-subtle hints that he would like us to be more than friends. I've never led him on and have reiterated that we are friends. We have some common interests, and we are both good people, but there are major differences, and frankly, I'm not attracted to him. Friends and family members have suggested that I'm crazy not to date him, but I just don't see him that way. Am I hurting him by remaining in his life if he is always going to harbor hope that I will grow to view him as a romantic partner? Why is friendship so completely underrated in our society? Signed, a friend indeed. Dear friend, I don't necessarily concur that friendship is underrated. In fact, I think that we in this country are currently experiencing something of an epidemic of loneliness. Most people crave and value having a special and intimate friendship connection. True and lasting friendships are worth their weight in gold. You seem worried that you will hurt Jeremy by maintaining a friendship instead of transitioning into a romance. But I think he is undermining the friendship by continuing to indicate that he wants to be romantically involved with you. A friendship should more or less remain in balance, with both parties respecting boundaries. Respond to his next not-so-subtle hint by saying, out loud, "That's never going to happen. Furthermore, this makes me uncomfortable. If you really believe you can't be friends with me without exerting this pressure, then maybe we should rethink our friendship." It would help for you to think about how you would respond if one of your daughters reported a similar dynamic with a friend. Would you advise her to keep quiet about her own needs? Our second letter is entitled, "Dear Amy, I'm replying to Taken Aback, whose parents want an open relationship. My sister had an open relationship when she was still married to her first husband. She told us about it as a heads up in case we stumbled upon people who became more to them. It might have been Mom's way of letting her kids know that her marriage is fine and not to worry too much about them. Signed, Ben There." Dear Ben There, I take your point, but in your example, the marriage obviously wasn't fine. Taken Aback's mother might have been telegraphing that message. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.